Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 2, The Dynasties of Manu. And we're beginning with text 25 with no purport. So we'll hear some more names. The son of Vimshati was Ramba, whose son was the great and religious king Kaninetra. O king, the son of Kaninetra was King Karandhama. So does anyone find that any of these names very important? Well, these people were important to themselves when they were here. And probably a lot of other people felt they were important too. But now they're just names. To us at least. From Karandhama came a son named Avikshit. And from Avikshit, a son named Maruta, who was the emperor. The great mystic Samvarta, the son of Angira, engaged Maruta in performing a sacrifice, yajna. The sacrificial paraphernalia of King Maruta was extremely beautiful, for everything was made of gold. Indeed, no other sacrifice can compare it to his. So here is Shukadeva Goswami. He's on the bank of the Ganges. 5,000 years ago, Pariksit Maharaj is sitting there. All the sages are there. Probably there's no electricity, no internet connection. There were no books, practically speaking. There was Shukadeva Goswami was not reading from a book on history. He was explaining as he had heard from his father, and perhaps also the point was he was actually realizing what he was speaking about. Otherwise, everyone would have fallen asleep. Just like we can repeat this, but practically speaking, it's just a bunch of words to us. Something about everything was made of gold and sacrifice, Marut. So if Shukadeva Goswami had to go a few hours through this, in the middle of the night especially, you know, everyone would have been snoring by that time. But there was a realization. In other words, Shukadeva Goswami was actually experiencing what he was talking about. It wasn't just a bunch of words and names. He was actually able to perceive these personalities in their glories, because they were actually glorious persons. And indeed, one of the elements which would probably be surprising that we may overlook is that if we read these verses again and again, although they're externally quite boring in one sense, in the sense that I never met Maruta personally, nor have I ever met anyone who knew him. I mean, it's just, I don't even know when this, I guess it's taking place, Dwarpa Yuga, Treta Yuga, I don't even know where he lived. And yet, if we read the same verse again and again, either in Sanskrit or in English, it doesn't get boring, actually. It gets better. So it must be something spiritual. Of course, I'm not going to try it out, because everyone will be asleep, probably. But it's the fact, if you try out and you read any verse in the Bhagavatam, you read it over and over again and memorize it, it doesn't become less interesting, it becomes more interesting. So it must be spiritual, although the topic is seemingly quite mundane. Now take up a book about Alexander the Great and see how many times you can read it before you get sick of it. In that sacrifice, King Indra became intoxicated. Oh, wow. Now it's getting interesting. The King of Heaven only follows one regular principle. All right. I should start worshiping Indra. Indra Kijai. In that sacrifice, King Indra became intoxicated by drinking a large quantity of Somarasa. Too much of a good thing. The Brahmanas recited ample contributions, and therefore they were satisfied. Oh, received ample contributions, and therefore they were satisfied. So even a Brahmin likes contributions.
For that sacrifice, the various demigods who control the winds offered foodstuffs. At least someone came and did some catering. The sacrifice. So it was the demigods who control the wind brought the food. They catered for the sacrifice. And the Vishvadevas were members of the assembly. So the Vishvadevas just watched. Because of the yajna performed by Maruta, everyone was pleased, especially the Brahmanas and Kshatriyas. Brahmanas are interested in receiving contributions as priests, and Kshatriyas are interested in drinking. I wonder what the Shudras and the Vaishyas are interested in. All of them, therefore, were satisfied with the different engagements. So we have to see that the Bhagavad Gita is dealing with two things. Well, it's dealing with many things. One thing is dealing with is what's going on externally, and the other is consciousness. And there's spiritual consciousness, and there's transcendental consciousness, and there are different degrees of each one of them. It's not all just, you're a Brahmin, you're a Brahmin, so therefore you're a good guy. And there's no problem. Or you're a Kshatriya, you're almost a good guy, but there's, you know, just have a few faults, like killing animals sometimes and killing people and a few other things. And generally speaking, anyone who reads something, we identify ourselves as the good guys. And it's hard reading the Bhagavad Gita because, practically speaking, the only good guys are devotees. And everyone else is not such a good guy. And even the devotees, you know, they do things which are, in the material estimation, not so nice. Like Bhima hitting Duryodhana below the waist and crippling him, and Yudhisthira Maharaj telling a lie, and all kinds of intrigues and things like that. And here in this ninth canto, it's hard to say who's the good guy. Prashadra, he gets cursed by Vashistha. So immediately Vashistha becomes a demon in our eyes. What is he doing, you know? What kind of Brahmin is that? You know, innocent person, all he did is swung his sword in the wrong way, and he gets cursed to become a Shudra. But then he goes back to Godhead. So the curse was good, but the person who cursed him is bad. What's going on? Why do they put all these things in there? I mean, I was confused enough about Krishna consciousness. And then they throw all these things in there, completely bewilder me, before the 10th canto, when we actually get into the real nectar of Krishna with the gopis. And something about the coward boys. Everyone likes a good game sometimes. So this is meant to give us some perspective about what the material world is. It's a place where we have an opportunity to raise our consciousness wherever our consciousness may be. And it's a place where there's danger, whatever our position may be. Whether we're a Kshatriya or a Brahmin, whatever. And anyone in the material world has their motivations. And as soon as we start judging, oh, he's just like me, yeah, the Brahmins, they're just greedy like I am. They want a contribution. And the Kshatriyas, yeah, they're just a bunch of drunkards. Otherwise, how could they fight like that? So we'll miss out, you know, unless we assimilate the knowledge and try to see things from different perspectives. Then when Prabhupada says something in a purport, immediately we hatch onto it and think, yeah, all those Kshatriyas, you know. They're not any better than I am. I haven't drunk for 50 years. They were all a bunch of drunkards. Because if we went out to a battlefield like Kurukshetra, we'd probably start drinking. Someone threw a pin, we stepped on a pin before the battlefield and we're in the hospital. What to speak of someone shooting arrows through our body? You know, after the first day, we're in the psych ward. And the Brahmins, they need contributions, but, you know, what kind of contributions were they really getting? An iPhone, a new computer, a new house, what were they getting? they were just, generally speaking, the actual Brahmins were getting enough to live on. They got a big contribution one day, and they gave it in charity the next day. So they needed contributions. And if they stayed there and performed the sacrifice for 3 weeks, at the end, there was nothing, they got nothing. The wives would really get on their case. You know, you came home, you had absolutely nothing. You know, we haven't eaten for 3 weeks. Well, you did the sacrifice. So it's necessary for some kind of offering to the Brahmins, or else the sacrifice wouldn't actually be complete. And unless the Kshatriyas got intoxicated, but here they're getting intoxicated by Somarasa, which is a kind of intoxication, but it actually allows the demigods to live for so many years. So it's not like, you know, it's not like our friends down the block with Union, is that it? It's like Indra went down to Union. No, it's a different type of intoxication. And then again, we have to recognize also that we're all intoxicated. But to speak of Indra, we don't have to take intoxication. We're already intoxicated. We're already hallucinating. We're thinking with this body, which is the worst hallucination. And at night, then we get into other kinds of hallucinations. And when, as it says in the Bhagavatam, when we take an actual intoxication, you know, which makes us more intoxicated, then we become crazy, as if we're not already crazy to some degree anyhow. But we just become confirmed. They can diagnose us and give us a label. Then you say, oh, I got a label. I'm a psychopath. Well, I must be really crazy. Everyone told me I'm crazy, but now it's confirmed. Schizophrenic, paranoid, psychopath. Yeah, all right. I got now I know who I am at least. And we go on. Now, I don't expect that anyone after, including myself, after reading this, I've read the Bhagavatam, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 times, the whole Bhagavatam. It takes a while to read it. But I don't remember any of these names, except for maybe Marut. That I remember. This, about that sacrifice where Indra got intoxicated. But otherwise, you know, Marut's son was Dama. Dama's son was Rajavardhana. Rajavardhana's son was Sudriti, and his son was Nara. I mean, how can you actually remember these things? What relevance does it have to our life? If you forgot it, what do you lose? And if you remember it, what do you gain? Of course, this is all leading up to Krishna's appearance, that Krishna didn't pop out of nothing. He came from a family. And obviously anyone who's in Krishna's family must have some credit. So it's like if we trace back our family line and we found out that Balaram was our great-great-great-great-grandfather, I mean, wouldn't you go around telling all the devotees about it? That's why they gave me the name Ram. But we can't do that. But Shukadeva Goswami is able to establish the glorious line that Krishna is going to come from. And therefore, we're going through all these names so that we understand that there is a line of personalities that were meritorious, and therefore, whether it was Vasudeva, Devaki, whatever, they actually had some lineage. Therefore, when Shukadeva Goswami was narrating to Pariksha Maharaj about Krishna dancing with the gopis to the dead of night, Pariksha Maharaj was seemingly quite surprised. Why is Krishna, who's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who already said in the Bhagavad Gita that whatever great man does, common men follow in his footsteps, well, why is he setting this example that a young boy, Krishna was only 8 years old, precocious, in the middle of the night is dancing with the young girls who are supposedly married? Wouldn't this lead to the Sahajiyas dancing and saying, well, our leader is Krishna. We just do whatever he did. So why did he do that? So one of the answers that Shukadeva Goswami said is that actually there must be something other, or Pariksit Maharaj was wondering, how is it possible that Krishna, who came from a line of ancestry which was so noble, how could he be so degraded, even at the age of 8 years old, that he could do something like that? So there must be something which was, you know, there must be some other explanation. Because Krishna, even if the gopis were lusty, and Krishna was, you know, but Krishna comes from such a noble line of ancestry, that how could it be possible that he could be induced to do such a thing? Now, of course, nowadays, anyone who's involved in a scandal, we think, well, he's just waiting for it. I already thought, you know, I was expecting it. I saw it 3 years ago. The way he looked at me, I understood exactly when he was going to fall down or she was going to fall down. No, but it's expected nowadays. Everyone's supposed to fall down. We're disappointed. As we heard, that one devotee was telling another devotee, you know, I've been married for 50 years. And the devotee was quite, 50 years? My God, how did you do it? Well, I had three different wives. Now, if you would have said to the same lady, that would have been a scandal or very unusual. But here, when Krishna was told, when Pariksit Maharaj was saying, how is it possible that a person such as Krishna, coming from such a noble family, could actually become so degraded? He couldn't understand it. Because family lineage actually had some bearing. The consciousness of the parents at the time of conception would determine what kind of soul would enter into the body. So if you have all noble people from a long line of disciples succession, then you expect only noble souls to enter, you know, into that family. And nowadays, no one knows, you know, what the consciousness, even the parents don't know what their consciousness was. They don't even know when the child was conceived. Matter of fact, most of the parents don't even know when it was born. You ask the mother, you know, what was the time of your child's birth? She said, oh, I think it was this day. I'm not so quite so sure. And she was right there. So Kali Yuga means quite confusing and conflicted. But in the other ages, it was confusing and conflicted, but a lot less than it is now. So people had a higher state of consciousness. And that's what, there are two different things that go on all the time. What's actually being done, and what was the state of consciousness in which it was being done? Generally, history is always, we assume that history in the Western world for the last, you know, couple of thousand years, which is our history, we assume that we know this king conquered this king, or this country rolled over this country and conquered it. And we assume it's, everyone had the same reason, lust, anger, and greed. You never hear that Slovenia was conquered by, you know, this country in order to liberate the people and bring them to God consciousness. Is there any such history in Slovenia? Is there? There is. That some king came along and who was fighting for Christ, and after then he told everyone to follow the regular principles and chant your rounds every day. Is that true? Yes? What's that? To Christ. Thou shalt not kill. And in the meantime, in the name of Christ, they took so much land and wealth and women. All for Christ's sake, of course. Yeah, I mean, everyone gives lip service to the spiritual figure, because otherwise it's very hard to cheat people. You have to claim. But when you look at it, it's just one greedy person in the name of, you know, maybe there was some morality, People went to church every day, every Sunday, and prayed for bread. So there was some piety there. But externally, for the most part, everyone understands it was just one king usurping the domain of another king, or one prime minister or president trying to grab something economic. Because Kali Yuga means only two things. There's no dharma. When Shingi Kauris Pariksramaraj practically dharma disappeared. And there's no liberation. No one's interested. Even the so-called religious people, they don't even know that they're not their body. They don't know that the aim of life is to go back to a spiritual world, because they don't know there's a spiritual world. They don't know that they have a spiritual body, they can live there. So there's no dharma, there's no liberation. So that only leaves economic development for sense gratification. So that's the history. And this history, of course, is a little different. This is before our present modern-day Kali Yuga history, which is history only for fighting for economic development for sense gratification. But there's some element of religiosity still there, even 5,000 years ago, or this is perhaps previous to that, in Krishna's dynasty, because there is actually an element of dharma, at least. It's not so much an element of moksha, although we find in some of the, there's the element there in the background, but mostly there's the element of, because we're hearing about kings, mostly the element of dharma. And the element of moksha is there, because Prashadra gave up everything and went and became Krishna conscious in the previous story. And therefore more explanation of King Prashadra is given than most of these other names, because although there was an element of dharma in their activities, because that's the duty of the Kshatriyas, but only those who actually achieved moksha, who actually became Krishna conscious, were actually explained. The son of Narada was Kevala, and his son was Dandumon, whose son was Vegavan. Vegavan's son was Buddha, and Buddha's son was Trinabindu, who became the king of the earth. Now, when we say the king of the earth, again, just to remind everyone, we're not talking about this little thing we call the planet Earth. We're talking a much greater, you know, kingdom. And a matter of fact, sometimes we just imagine, you know, when he was king, he was also ruling over Slovenia or America, but these things didn't exist. We have no idea what the earth was like when these personalities were ruling, or what they were like. When, who was that king who killed, who was sleeping for a long time, and then he opened his eyes and he burnt? Muchukunda, yes, Muchukunda. When Muchukunda woke up, and that was Dwarpa Yuga, I guess it was, yeah, Krishna was in Dwarpa Yuga. He woke up, he looked around, he saw all the trees were like little bushes. Now in Dwarpa Yuga, the trees were much bigger than they are now. But he thought they were little bushes. So we can't imagine what the earth was like. Matter of fact, if we read the Ramayana, we find out about what was going on in the jungle. We think, well, this is really fictitious. This is just, you know, Valmiki was really high on some drug in the forest when he wrote this. It's an interesting story, but wow. Kandamba, who was, he had arms which were eight miles long, or 12 yojanas, and he had a trident who was sticking elephants and lions and tigers and all kinds of boars onto the trident, because that's what he had for breakfast. And he didn't have, all he had was, he didn't have, I guess he had eyes, but he just had a hole in his face, which was his mouth. That was it. Not exactly the most attractive person. But he was a hungry person. He had a good appetite. So we hear about that, and then of course he grabbed Ram and Lakshman in his two arms, and Ram and Lakshman cut them off. So we can't imagine how big Ram and Lakshman were. I mean, it's the whole, unless we actually utilize our imagination and start getting out of our little box of, you know, what the forest is like in Trivali Park, and imagine that's what the forest was like in Ramachandra's pastimes. Or that, you know, what was going on in Dwarpa Yuga is exactly the same as going on here. Then we'll miss out upon a lot of the excitement which is going on too. Oh, best of the Apsaras. The highly qualified girl name, the best of the Apsaras, the highly qualified girl named Alambusha, accepted the similarly qualified Trina Bindu as her husband. She gave birth to a few sons and a daughter known as Ilavila. So again, the Apsaras coming down and these kings becoming their husbands of the Apsaras. I mean, this is, we have to broaden our mind. And even if we can't perceive it, at least we can theoretically accept that there was another reality that was going on beyond our present limited reality. After the great sage Vishvarava, the master of the mystic yoga, received absolute knowledge from his father, he begot in the womb of Ilavila, the greatly celebrated son known as Kubera, the giver of money. So now we know at least where Kubera came from. He also didn't pop out of nowhere. Who is his father? I guess Vishvarava was a Brahmin, by the way. So he gave birth to a Rakshasa. One of his sons was Kuvera, and the other one was Ravana. Anyway, it's an exciting world. Trina Bindu had three sons named Vishala, Shunya Bandhu, and Duma Rakdu. Among these three, Vishala created a dynasty and constructed a palace called Vaishali. The son of Vishala was known as Hema Chandra. His son was Dumraksha, and his son was Samyama, whose sons were Devyaja and Krishasva. And the last verse in this chapter, the son of Krishvava was Samadatta, who performed Ashvatthama sacrifices and thus satisfied the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu. By worshipping the Supreme Lord, he achieved the most exalted post, a resident on the planet to which great mystic yogis are elevated. The sons of Samadatta was Sumati, whose son was Jamanjaya, and all the kings appearing in the dynasty of Vishala properly maintained the celebrated position of King Trinabindu. All right. Let's get ready for the next set of names. Now, there's a story in between that. Next is a story, and then there's another. There's stories after that before we get into a whole. Actually, I think, we'll have to wait until, I believe, until chapter 12, another 9 chapters before we get into the dynasties again. So if you like name calling, you have to wait another 9 chapters. But there'll be stories. Romance, intrigue, battles, lying, cheating, just normal everyday life. Any questions or comments? Yes.
To what extent the Garbha Dana Samskara helped to conceive a good child?
To some extent. It's better than chanting Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck. You know Mickey Mouse? You've heard of Mickey Mouse? Mickey Ratone?
Yeah,
it's hope that you chant. There's a quality to the chanting too. Not that you, for us it's chanting 50 rounds. It's not like every round that falls down, oh my God, this is torture. No, it's a consciousness. If we're in Krishna consciousness, as much as we can, just like Krishna consciousness is, to remember Krishna's name, to feel Krishna's presence in his name, then to remember Krishna's qualities, along with all the other things, his name, his qualities, feeling his presence, remember his qualities, then remembering his associates, that he's not alone, and remember their qualities, and they're into their exchanges, and which generally gradually leads into their pastimes, which leads into full absorption of seeing his pastimes in this material world externally, how everything is a pastime of Krishna, and remembering his internal pastimes. And then actually entering into the pastime in our spiritual body. So that's called offenseless chanting. Now we can chant millions of rounds, it says, and only touch the surface of just remembering Krishna's name sometimes when we're chanting. Or we can chant, without even chanting, we can be absorbed in our spiritual existence and our spiritual identity and participate in Krishna's pastimes. So it's the quality of the chanting that's important. But it's better than chanting anything else.
So in other words, the chanting of the mantra...
No, you use the mic.
No? Okay. In other words, the chanting of the Mahamantra will be more effective at the time of conception of a child than the Garbhodana Samskara itself?
No, that's what we're doing. No one's going to do the Garbhodana Samskara in this age. We don't even know how to chant Hare Krishna, which is because of the Vedic mantras. So the Hare Krishna mantra is what our disciples probably recommended. Mm-hmm.
Another point, Guru Maharaj, we read in these verses names of famous personalities like Buddha, Kubera,
It's not that Buddha, it's a different Buddha.
It's a different Buddha, okay. Right. And what about Nara? Is not Nara? It is not Nara, Nara Narayan?
No.
It's different Nara, okay.
No. Okay. Unless it's mentioned, we don't. There's only so many names. They're used a lot.
Right. Thank you, Guru Maharaj.
Anything else? Yes.
So I understand that history for us is important if we want to study minutiously. And we also have this type of history and name calling in the Bible. So it is important. But I wonder, why was it important for Maharaj Parikshit, who had only 7 days to hear all these names?
Well, as I said, when he's hearing these names, Shukadev Goswami, by his influence, it wasn't just like hearing a bunch of names rattled off. They were actually experiencing transcendental ecstasy when they were hearing these names. They were actually experiencing the great qualities of these people. Just like when we chant Hare Krishna, we hardly experience Krishna's quality. We hardly experience his presence. But when he was chanting these names, these great personalities were actually present in his recitation. So it wasn't just, rattling off some names. It was actually a transcendental experience for everyone involved. Did he know about them? He experienced them.
So because you say that he experienced the ecstasy of the quality, so that means that he knew about these personalities before.
He experienced them.
Okay.
It was revealed. Krishna revealed them to him. We don't know anything unless Krishna reveals it to us. So Krishna revealed this to Shukadeva Goswami. Now if we chant these names, Krishna may not reveal everything to us, because we're not qualified, but he was fully qualified. So maybe some time will come. Should be a time when we're chanting these names, and these things will be experienced by us too. Otherwise, how was Gadadhar Pandit? He was reading the Bhagavatam every day, and his tears from his eyes, because of the ecstasy he was experiencing in love, wetted the Bhagavatam, so he washed away the written words in the Bhagavatam. Unless he was experiencing what the Bhagavatam was. It wasn't that, you know, I got up to the ninth canto, and we're in this, you know, second chapter, let me skip it, it's, you know, gets to something more interesting. The whole Bhagavatam is interesting to one on the spiritual platform. Equally interesting, all of it. Okay, anything else? Grantharaya Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.